members of the cabinet, members of the White House staff, all of our friends here, I think the record should show that this is one of those spontaneous things that we always arrange whenever the president comes in to speak. And it will be so reported in the press, and we don't mind, because they've got to call it if they see it. But on our part, believe me, it is spontaneous. You are here to say goodbye to us. And we don't have a good word for it in English. The best is au revoir. We'll see you again. I just met with the members of the White House staff, you know, those that serve here in the White House, day in and day out. And I asked them to do what I ask all of you to do to the extent that you can and are, of course, are requested to do so, to serve our next president as you have served me and previous presidents, because many of you have been here for many years with devotion and dedication. Because this office, great as it is, can only be as great as the men and women who work for and with the president. This house, for example, I was thinking of it as we walked down this hall, and I was comparing it to some of the great houses of the world that I've been in. This isn't the biggest house, many are, and most. And even smaller countries are much bigger. This isn't the finest house. Many in Europe, particularly, and in China, Asia, have paintings of great, great value, things that we just don't have here, and probably will never have until we are 1,000 years old or older. But this is the best house. It's the best house because it has something far more important than numbers of people who serve, far more important than numbers of rooms or how big it is, far more important than numbers of magnificent pieces of art. This house has a great heart. And that heart comes from those who serve. I was rather sorry they didn't come down. We said goodbye to them upstairs. But they're really great. And I recall after so many times I've made speeches, they've been some of them pretty tough. You'd always come back, or after a hard day, and my days usually have run rather long, I'd always get a lift from them, because I might be a little down, but they always smiled. And so it is with you. I look around here and I see so many in this staff that, you know, I should have been by your offices and shaking hands, and I'd love to have talked to you and found out how to run the world. Everybody wants to tell the president what to do. And boy, he needs to be told many times, but I just haven't had the time. But I want to know, I want you to know, that each and every one of you, I know, is indispensable to this government. I'm proud of this cabinet. I'm proud of all the members who have served in our cabinet. I'm proud of our sub-cabinet. I'm proud of our White House staff. As I pointed out last night, sure we've done some things wrong in this administration. And The top man always takes the responsibility, and I've never ducked it. But I want to say one thing. We can be proud of it. 5.5 years. No man or no woman came into this administration and left it with more of this world's goods than when he came in. No man or no woman ever profited at the public expense or the public till. That tells something about you. Mistakes, yes. But for personal gain, never. You did what you believed in. Sometimes right, sometimes wrong. And I only wish that I were a wealthy man. Present time, I've got to find a way to pay my taxes. And if I were, I'd like to recompense you for the sacrifices that all of you have made to serve in government. But you are getting something in government. And I want you to tell this to your children. And I hope the nation's children will hear it too. Something in government service that is far more important than money. It's a cause bigger than yourself. It's the cause of making this the greatest nation in the world, the leader of the world, because without our leadership, the world will know nothing but war, possibly starvation, or worse in the years ahead. With our leadership, it will know peace, it will know plenty. We have been generous, and we will be more generous in the future as we are able to. But most important, we must be strong here, strong in our hearts, strong in our souls, strong in our belief, and strong in our willingness to sacrifice, as you have been willing to sacrifice in a pecuniary way, to serve in government. Something else I'd like for you to tell your young people. You know, people often come in and say, what'll I tell my kids? You know, they look at government and it's sort of a rugged life, and they see the mistakes that are made. They get the impression that everybody is here for the purpose of feathering his nest. That's why I made this earlier point. Not in this administration. Not one single man or woman. And I say to them, there are many fine careers. This country needs good farmers, good businessmen, good plumbers, good carpenters. I remember my old man. I think that they would have called him sort of a little man, common man. He didn't consider himself that way. You know what he was? He was a streetcar motorman first. And then he was a farmer. And then he had a lemon ranch. It was the poorest lemon ranch in California, I can assure you. He sold it before they found oil in it. And then he was a grocer. But he was a great man. Because he did his job. And every job counts, up to the hilt, regardless of what happened. Nobody will ever write a book, probably, about my mother. Well, I guess all of you would say this about your mother. My mother was a saint. And I think of her, two boys dying of tuberculosis, nursing four others, in order that she could take care of my older brother for 3 years in Arizona. And seeing each of them die, and when they died, it was like one of her own. Yes? She will have no books written about her. But she was a saint. Now, however, we look to the future. Had a little quote in a speech last night from T.R. As you know, I kind of like to read books. I'm not educated, but I do read books. And the T.R. quote was a pretty good one. It's another one I found as I was reading my last night in the White House. And this quote is about a young man. He was a young lawyer in New York. He'd married a beautiful girl. And they had a lovely daughter. And then suddenly, she died. And this is what he wrote. This was in his diary. He said, "She was beautiful in face and form, and lovelier still in spirit. As a flower she grew, and as a fair young flower she died. Her life had been always in the sunshine. There had never come to her a single great sorrow. None ever knew her who did not love and revere her for her bright and sunny temper and her saintly unselfishness. Fair, pure, and joyous as a maiden. Loving, tender, and happy as a young wife. When she had just become a mother, when her life seemed to be just begun, and then the years seemed so bright before her, then by a strange and terrible fate, death came to her. And when my heart's dearest died, the light went from my life forever." That was T.R. in his 20s. He thought the life had gone from his life forever, but he went on. And he not only became president, but as an ex-president, he served his country. Always in the arena, tempestuous, strong, sometimes wrong, sometimes right. But he was a man. And as I leave, let me say, that's an example I think all of us should remember. We think sometimes when things happen that don't go the right way, we think that when you don't pass the bar exam the first time. I happened to, but I was just lucky. I mean, my writing was so poor, the bar examiner said we just got to let the guy through. We think that when someone dear to us dies, we think that when we lose an election, we think that when we suffer a defeat, that all has ended. We think, as T.R. said, that the light had left his life forever. Not true. It's only a beginning, always. The young must know it. The old must know it. They must always sustain us. Because the greatness comes not when things go always good for you, but the greatness comes and you're really tested when you take some knocks, some disappointments, when sadness comes. Because only if you've been in the deepest valley can you ever know how magnificent it is to be on the highest mountain. And so I say to you on this occasion, we leave. We leave proud of the people who have stood by us and worked for us and served this country. We want you to be proud of what you've done. We want you to continue to serve in government, if that is your wish. Always give your best. Never get discouraged. Never be petty. Always remember, others may hate you, but those who hate you don't win unless you hate them. And then you destroy yourself. And so we leave with high hopes, in good spirit, and with deep humility, and with very much gratefulness in our hearts. I can only say to each and every one of you, we come from many faiths. We pray perhaps to different gods, but really the same God in a sense. But I want to say for each and every one of you, not only will we always remember you, not only will we always be grateful to you, but always you will be in our hearts and you will be in our prayers. Thank you very much.
His family. For a moment there, he held his hand up and made a V for victory signal.
And President Nixon showing a thumbs up salute and a smile leaves the room.
For the inauguration of Gerald Ford.
This is a CBS News special report. The nation's 38th president takes office. I'm Neil Strauser with Hal Walker, CBS News Washington, reporting on the CBS radio network. In the East Room of the White House just about 2 hours ago, Richard M. Nixon spoke his last public words as the nation's 37th president.
I want to say for each and every one of you, not only will we always remember you, not only will we always be grateful to you, but always, you will be in our hearts, and you will be in our prayers.
You are experiencing lung difficulties. Now, emanating from Los Angeles.
The room of the White House, before the same cabinet officers, many of the same White House staffers, but before many new faces as well, the nation's 38th president is about to be sworn into office, Gerald Ford, the vice president. He may already be officially, legally, President of the United States, according to a note handed to me just moments ago. The resignation letter from President Nixon was delivered to Secretary of State Kissinger about 11:35 this morning, about 20 minutes ago. And that letter merely said, "Dear Mr. Secretary, I hereby resign the office of President of the United States. Sincerely, Richard Nixon." Nothing said there about the noon Eastern Daylight Time that for resignation, which Mr. Nixon mentioned last night in his speech to the nation. And at the moment of his resignation, Gerald Ford, in spite of not having yet taken the oath of office, would become the President of the United States. Beginning this day, Gerald Ford rose about 6 o'clock in the morning, and he left for his office in the Executive Office Building, still as Vice President, very early to begin conferences with his staff. And he was asked, as he left his home in Alexandria, Virginia, ready to move into the White House now in a day or two at least, he was asked how he felt as he approached this day.
I think a feeling of sadness on the one hand and expectation to start to build on the other. It does strike me as a terribly heavy responsibility, which we're going to try and work on and do our very best.
The president talked last night of the heavy responsibilities that were going to be on your shoulders today. Do you feel those? Can't help but feel that way.
And now those heavy responsibilities come to Gerald Ford. In the East Room is CBS News correspondent Hal Walker. What is the scene, Hal?
Neil, for the last several minutes, the persons invited to this historic swearing-in ceremony have been filing into the East Room. There are members of Congress, the leadership, members of the Nixon cabinet, and we understand many of those members of the Nixon cabinet will continue on as part of the Ford cabinet. Melvin Laird is here. Melvin Laird, about whom there's been so much speculation as a possible vice presidential nomination. There is no sign. Oh, I do see at this moment John McCormick, the former Speaker of the House of Representatives, where Gerald Ford spent so much of his public life and his career, has just come in. We heard the helicopters landing on the South Lawn a few minutes ago, and we understand that former Speaker John McCormick was flown here for this occasion. He is in the process at the moment of talking with Secretary of State Henry Kissinger and present Speaker of the House Carl Albert. The East Room, Neil, is as full, I think, as I've ever seen it. It is jammed full with reporters, with photographers, with cameramen, and there's just not an inch of space anywhere except the focus, the center of the room, where we are waiting for the new president, Mr. Gerald Ford, to be sworn in by the Chief Justice Warren Burger. And Mr. Ford will be accompanied here by members of his family. They will be arranged, as we think they've laid out spaces on the stage for the family to be arranged around the new president as he takes his oath of office as the 38th president.
Gerald Ford has emphasized his congressional background by inviting the leadership of the Congress, members of both parties, to be here for this affair. There is also some of the trapping of the more formal inauguration we're familiar with on January 20th. Members of the diplomatic corps are in the East Room. And, of course, as you mentioned, members of the, we must now call the Ford cabinet. We know at least that Secretary of State Kissinger is staying on. Last night, the Interior Secretary, Rogers Morton, told us he'd been asked to stay on and would gladly.
Neil, among the guest list here, there's an interesting group called the Transition Group, which consists of Bryce Harlow, a counselor to President Nixon, Bill White of the U.S. Steel, and Phil Buchan, a Grand Rapids attorney and longtime friend of Gerald Ford, and a couple listed as Mr. and Mrs.
Ladies
Bill Scranton. And now,
the Chief Justice of the United States.
Warren Burger is being introduced, the audience rising. The Chief Justice flew back this morning from a vacation in Holland to administer the oath to Gerald Ford. Everybody waits. He has not yet appeared in view of the standing audience. Already on Capitol Hill, the Senate has passed a resolution calling Gerald Ford a good and faithful friend and pledging the cooperation of the Congress as he assumes the presidency. That resolution introduced jointly by the Republican leader Hugh Scott and the Democratic leader Mike Mansfield.
And now
the Chief Justice Warren Burger in his black robes is making his way up to the podium at the front of the East Room, standing by one of the yellow chairs.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Vice President of the United States and Mrs. Ford.
Last time we saw Gerald Ford this morning, he was on the south lawn of the White House waving goodbye to Richard Nixon, who is now flying westward. Now he's making his way into the East Room, past the applauding standing members of the audience, up onto the podium with his wife in a light blue dress, stands between Gerald Ford and Chief Justice Warren Burger.
President, are you prepared to take the oath of office as President of the United States?
I am, sir.
If you will raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, Gerald R. Ford, do solemnly swear.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do solemnly swear.
That I will faithfully execute.
That I will faithfully execute.
The office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States.
And will, to the best of my ability.
And will, to the best of my ability.
Preserve, protect, and defend.
Preserve, protect, and defend
the Constitution of the United States.
The Constitution of the United States.
So help me God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
Justice, the first person possibly to speak those words. Congratulations, Mr. President. Gerald Ford and his wife, now the Chief Justice.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Mr. Chief Justice, my dear friends, my fellow Americans, the oath that I have taken is the same oath that was taken by George Washington and by every president under the Constitution. But I assume the presidency under extraordinary circumstances never before experienced by Americans. This is an hour of history that troubles our minds and hurts our hearts. Therefore, I feel it is my first duty to make an unprecedented compact with my countrymen. Not an inaugural address, not a fireside chat, not a campaign speech. Just a little straight talk among friends. And I intend it to be the first of many. I am acutely aware that you have not elected me as your president by your ballots. So I ask you to confirm me as your president with your prayers. And I hope that such prayers will also be the first of many. If you have not chosen me by secret ballot, neither have I gained office by any secret promises. I have not campaigned either for the presidency or the vice presidency. I have not subscribed to any partisan platform. I am indebted to no man and only to one woman, my dear wife. As I begin this very difficult job, I have not sought this enormous responsibility.
but I will not shirk it. Those who nominated and confirmed me as Vice President were my friends and are my friends. They were of both parties, elected by all the people and acting under the Constitution in their name. It is only fitting, then, that I should pledge to them and to you that I will be the president of all the people. Thomas Jefferson said the people are the only sure reliance for the preservation of our liberty. And down the years, Abraham Lincoln renewed this American article of faith, asking, is there any better way or equal hope in the world? I intend on next Monday next to request of the Speaker of the House of Representatives and the President pro tempore of the Senate the privilege of appearing before the Congress to share with my former colleagues and with you, the American people, my views on the priority business of the nation and to solicit your views and their views. And may I say to the Speaker and the others, if I could meet with you right after these remarks, I would appreciate it. Even though this is late in an election year, there is no way we can go forward except together. And no way anybody can win except by serving the people's urgent needs. We cannot stand still or slip backwards. We must go forward now, together. To the peoples and the governments of all friendly nations, and I hope that could encompass the whole world, I pledge an uninterrupted and sincere search for peace. America will remain strong and united, but its strength will remain dedicated to the safety and sanity of the entire family of man, as well as to our own precious freedom. I believe that truth is the glue that holds government together, not only our government, but civilization itself. That bond, though stained, is unbroken at home and abroad. In all my public and private acts as your president, I expect to follow my instincts of openness and candor with full confidence that honesty is always the best policy in the end. My fellow Americans, our long national nightmare is over. Our Constitution works. Our great republic is a government of laws and not of men. Here, the people rule. But there is a higher power. By whatever name, we honor him, who ordains not only righteousness but love, not only justice but mercy. As we bind up the internal wounds of Watergate, more painful and more poisonous than those of foreign wars, let us restore the golden rule to our political process, and let brotherly love purge our hearts of suspicion and of hate. In the beginning, I asked you to pray for me. Before closing, I asked again your prayers for Richard Nixon and for his family. May our former president, who brought peace to millions, find it for himself. May God bless and comfort his wonderful wife and daughters, whose love and loyalty will forever be a shining legacy to all who bear the lonely burdens of the White House. I can only guess at those burdens, although I have witnessed at close hand the tragedies that befell three presidents and the lesser trials of others. with all the strength and all the good sense I have gained from life, with all the confidence of my family, my friends, and my dedicated staff impart to me, and with the goodwill of countless Americans I have encountered in recent visits to 40 states, I now solemnly reaffirm my promise I made to you last December 6th to uphold the Constitution, to do what is right as God gives me to see the right, and to do the very best I can for America. God helping me, I will not let you down. Thank you.
Sir Gerald Ford has made his first address as the nation's 38th president. He stands now, right arm around his wife, smiling, acknowledging the applause of this audience. Members of the cabinet, members of the White House staff, the diplomatic corps, leaders of the Congress present for this occasion. It's notable that the vice president, or the president now, has stated that he will seek the privilege of speaking before a joint session of the Congress next Monday to lay out his views and seek the views of the Congress. Has gone on immediately beginning his work with what, of course, is a Congress dominated by the opposite party, by saying he would appreciate meeting with the Speaker and other leaders of the Congress immediately following this address in the East Room of the White House.